All right, eyes up front. Who wants to start? Now that you've seen them both, what are some of the similarities between Nosferatu and The Lost Boys?
The last fire will rise behind those eyes. Black house will rock. Blind boys don't.
I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren, and we are The Rants Macabre, a part of the Fangoria Podcast Network. For more information about the network, including other programs, how to follow the show, and find past episodes of The Rants Macabre, please visit fangoria.com.
Why isn't the horror film genre regarded with the same sense of art as, say, films like Forrest Gump or Million Dollar Baby? Why does the public expect less? And why are they so surprised when something horrific and great, like The Witch, comes along? Is it that maybe the average film watcher doesn't know what to look for? That they rely on the press to tell them what to think, and since horror movies are usually the last to be reviewed, they're the last to be appreciated? I didn't see any of last year's Oscar films, but I saw almost every film up for Fangoria Chainsaw Awards. What about studying film in academia? Sure, there are film classes in college, usually showing one horror film throughout the semester, but imagine yourself back in high school. Scary, I know. But imagine that there was a class you could take that spent weeks catering to your interest in horror film and dissecting it and analyzing it. This week, Darren and I are joined by my mom, Lori, a retired public school art teacher. And this week, we get to be jealous of her ex-students and learn about the horror section of her art and film appreciation class.
Welcome to the show, Lori.
Thanks.
Okay, so how did all this start, this class?
It started about 20 years ago. They needed a semester-long course because if a kid flunks math or they flunk a science class, they can't take second semester.
That's so sad.
It is sad.
This should be a privilege, this class.
What is second semester? Oh, like continuing
yes.
in that grade. Oh, the second half
the
of the
second
year.
Okay.
And they don't
year.
Have anywhere to put the kids.
Right. And so what they do is they have to find some place for them, and they can't just put them in study halls. So they were starting to dump them into my studio art class.
I might have failed classes on purpose.
Yeah, I know. This is a total privilege.
Well, and I did start getting kids that were like, I dropped that science class so I could take your class, which was kind of cool, but they need the science to graduate.
you don't need film class to graduate?
No. So they came to me and they said, what could you offer for a semester? Because I got tired of kids being dumped in studio art because first semester is learning basics and I get them second semester and that's, you know, you're trying to paint with acrylics when you haven't even learned how to draw with a pencil. So I made up this art appreciation film class, and it started out as a semester class. Well, then it turned out to be a two-semester class, and eventually I offered it even as an advanced class because so many kids wanted to come and hang out. And
of course, who doesn't want to learn about movies?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how it kind of started, was to fill a need that the school had.
And so what are the ages of these students when they were taking your class?
Anything from freshmen to seniors, but I usually preferred it to be juniors and seniors because I show a lot of R-rated movies, so I wanted not to have to worry about parents as much.
And how does that, I mean, clearly, though, even if they're under 17, do they need a permission slip?
Yeah.
Yes, I made a permission slip that I am sure would hold up in court. But it said, you know, that I give my son or daughter permission to watch R-rated movies, keeping in mind that the majority of the content was language and actually violence. Parents, believe it or not, preferred the violence over sexual content.
Yeah, it seems to be very American.
Yeah, it's just like, okay, something natural like having sex or someone getting their face ripped off. I'd rather see my kid get something, their face ripped off. That was great.
And yeah. I had a parent actually call and say that. She was like, and her son was a senior, and she was like, I don't care if he sees murder and mayhem and people getting blown up, but if he sees a boob, I'm calling the school.
Wow. She off the Mayflower, that lady. She's a Puritan.
Yeah. And I think to this day, that child has still not ever seen a boob.
Aww. So. Wow. I guess that's part of like being in the public school system, though. I guess you have to follow these kind of rules.
Yeah.
Especially,
ridiculous rules. Wow. Well, how long has it been since you taught the class?
I just retired a year ago. So
okay.
So a year, since I've taught it. But I mean, it's changed over time. Mm-hmm. I added more stuff, and because they gave me more semesters to teach it, I was able to, you know.
Yeah, not even like a whole year. That'd be awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd be far better viewed. What's the movie version of well read? Well viewed.
We have a listener that knows a word for that, I need to know. Because I would like to describe myself thusly.
So in the years that you were teaching the class, did you find a distinct difference between the way kids watch movies and the way adults watch movies?
Oh, definitely. And I had a lot of students who at the end of the year would tell me, or even the end of the semester, go, thanks, you've ruined movies for me because now I look for all of this stuff.
Oh.
And things I thought were good, I realize they were just manipulating me.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so they don't see things the same, and it was kind of fun to get them to open their eyes up for some of this stuff.
Sure. And, I mean, that's kind of the point of education in general, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, right? Isn't that what most teachers strive for?
To question, yeah.
Yeah, but I guess this is one of those subjects, though, that you can't test, and I think so much of education nowadays is making those test scores.
Yeah, right. It's tough to write a standardized test, and in Friday the 13th, Part 2, was Jason the killer or was it his mother? It's fill in the bubble. So in terms of horror, I mean, over your experience, you've sat with adult audiences and you've sat with kid audiences in this case. Is there a marked difference between the way kids react?
There really is. And part of it is with adults, they're more cynical.
Yeah.
And with kids, they're... it's all new. Even if they've watched stuff before, when you're pointing things out, it's all new. And so you get to see things from kids' eyes, which is a cooler perspective. One of the movies we're not going to talk a whole lot about, but I show Night of the Living Dead.
Okay.
And spoiler alert, the end gets them every time.
Oh.
I have had more kids that I've actually had a girl get up at the end and walk out of the room. And I know everybody should know this, right? So when Ben gets shot,
mm-hmm.
and she stands up, her mouth is wide open, and she goes, "That sucks," and she walked out. Walked out.
I love
of the
that
class.
Ending. It's one of my most favorite. That's why I love that movie so much, because I love a I love an ending like that.
It's one of the all time most cruel endings. Things to do to an audience. Yeah,
and that's how all of my kids viewed it. But she was the first one. She just stood up. She was so angry. She just walked out.
So I'm curious, while we're on the note of that one, we're mostly going to be focusing on Nosferatu and The Lost Boys, but I'm curious, when kids watch the 1968 Night of the Living Dead, and that end point is, you know, it sort of pulls back to the social commentary moment, is it useful as a tool to sort of inform kids to, like, well, 1968 was a pretty rough year for the country, and this was kind of representative.
And that's what I do with all of the art. That with the art appreciation class, we pull in what's happening culturally at the time the art is happening or whatever. And so with that, we talk about the fact that that actor didn't want to slap Barbara, even though as soon as she opened her mouth, I wanted to.
Yeah, she sucks so bad in that one.
You know,
the actor was afraid to have to walk the streets after that.
Right.
Because people would have seen him do that. And again, in rural Pennsylvania in 1968, you're really taking your chances.
Yeah, you have a black actor slapping a white lady. She really deserved it, though. God.
Oh, yeah. My kids were cheering when she gets pulled out the window by her brother. You know, they're like, yes, finally, she's gone. So, so it is. It's good for social commentary, and we talk about what's happening and why that makes that film important or why it's done the direction it goes because of what's happening in the country or in the world at that time.
Yeah. It's interesting you said before that the students often say that, you spoiled movies for them because now they're thinking analytically. But in the context of, especially older horror movies, the context of the time in which it was made, informs so much.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the biggest thrills I get doing the podcast is sort of, watching the movie, but then reading about it and reading about the production of it and sort of giving it a context in, American culture, not always American, but it makes me appreciate it that much more.
Right, exactly. Yeah. That's always one of those things where I like to go into a movie not knowing anything about it. And when Darren watches a movie, I think you read about it all before and you learn a lot about it. And I like to know nothing and go, that's just how I am. So I can understand why your kids would be like, no, this ruins it for me. But I don't know. I like knowing absolutely nothing and then finding out about it later.
Yeah, yeah. And it, I guess the great horror movies you wind up watching a second, third, fourth time, and it's that much better down mm-hmm. the line for that extra information, that extra analysis.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, so you gave us a long list of movies that you had shown, and you actually have shown a number of films throughout the years in your class. We chose today to go over 1922's Nosferatu and 1987's The Lost Boys. Would you have shown these movies together, or did I, me and Darren, did we create like a really bad lesson plan?
Well, if you did, I actually created that bad lesson
good.
Plan.
Because you did?
Okay.
I taught the two together because of there are references in The Lost Boys to Nosferatu. I mean, the head vampire is Max.
Yeah.
Okay.
Max Schreck. It's a nod to Max Schreck. And so there were just little things about it that kind of pulled the two together. And Nosferatu was a hard view for my kids. Not only is it black and white, but
right.
it's silent, and it's a hard watch. Mm. It's very difficult for them. They do a lot of giggling, and you know, they just think a lot of it is pretty lame, but they're willing to sit through it when I've given them, you know, some background. Let's look at it for this. Let's try to figure out what's going on with that.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking for things like the shadow that the vampire casts on things, because that's very, very important.
Mm. But you don't go super deep. Like, so you're not like harping on something like German Expressionism. That's maybe a college level course.
Right. That would be too much for, you know, number one, they're high school age kids, so that's pretty deep. Number two, I have a limited amount of time to try to throw all this in, and it's 48-minute classes.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time you do a little bit of explanation, they might get to watch. And what I like to do is talk at the beginning, give them at least 20 minutes solid viewing time, and then recap and go over a few things after they've seen it.
That would suck, like, if you were showing The Mist. And you like to break it up.
Yeah.
That would be like the most terrible watching experience ever. Did any of them ever watch the movie on their own because they couldn't wait for the next class, maybe? Or
oh yeah, I would get that all the time, and they'd come in the next day and they'd go, I just couldn't wait, so I watched the whole thing. And I go, well, don't give it away. Just hold on to it for a few more days.
Because a lot of these kids hadn't seen these movies before.
Right. No, because I try to pick things that they would, and teenagers are pretty much into the action thing.
Yeah.
The more cars blow up, the better.
Okay.
Yeah,
kind of
summer
a thing.
Blockbusters. I mean, at this rate, like, summer blockbusters are catering to mm-hmm. high school kids.
That's true. I was, like, obsessed with the Sundance Channel when I was in high school. So I was watching, like, Kiss Me Guido. I was watching all these short films that no one knew about, and I thought it was so cool. But I wasn't, obviously. All right, so let's kick this off with a look at the 1922 F.W. Murnau film, Nosferatu, or Nosferatu, A Symphony of Horror, which I think is awesomer.
That's the first time I've seen that extra title.
A Symphony of Horror. I watched the Kino re-release, so maybe that's why. But it was originally called The Symphony of Horror.
Yeah.
Originally released overseas in 1922, the film company Prana Film was sued by the Bram Stoker estate and was bankrupt that following year. However, they already had sent copies, like, out to everybody else, and Nosferatu actually became a cult success by 1929 in the States. It was actually really, really popular. It's kind of cool to think of, like, the 20s having this underground kind of film. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's a secret film.
Yeah, it's funny that hitting the United States in 1929, you know, when I was watching it again this time around, I was thinking the Phantom of the Opera, the original.
Uh-huh.
And in terms of, like, I don't know, I've got a lot to say about Nosferatu deep in, but I thought it was funny that the Prana Film company going out of business, in the details for it, like, one of the guys knew what he was doing, and the other guy was just a noted occultist.
Like, yeah, he's really into it, though.
Yeah,
like a noted occultist, which that guy in Shadow of the Vampire is played by Udo Kier, who, you know, like, if Udo Kier shows up,
he's up to something.
And if Udo Kier is playing you in a film, you know you're a weird fucker.
So, starring the infamous Max Schreck as Count Orlok, Gustav von Wangenheim as Hooter. And some other people stand out. Alexander Granach as Nock.
Yeah. He's awesome, by the way. But you know what? I think I have a thing for Renfields.
Yeah.
Like, I think there's something about me that, like, I don't know why. Bug Eaters, obviously, are my jam. Because I think Knock is so good.
Forgive me, but Knock is the very, is our starting guy?
No, that's Hutter. I mean, that's Thomas Hutter. But Knock is the maybe anti-Semitic. He's like an accountant bookie guy.
Oh, with the eyebrows.
With the eyebrows, yes. And everything.
That's how my kids describe him. The guy with the eyebrows.
With the eyebrows.
I'm glad I have that in common.
And then later he like, he's the one who later then, so he tells Thomas to go and get Count Orlok and move Orlok into the place next to your house that's run down and shitty.
He's the real estate guy. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And then he gets put in the insane asylum. And then, I mean, there's so much to talk about and so much I want to like get into, but there's this great scene where Knock is on the roof and all the townspeople think that Knock is like killing people, even though it's Orlok, and they're throwing literally like bricks at this man and he's on the roof and there's a scene where he like, he keeps repeatedly getting hit in the head with bricks. Yeah, and it's the best scene ever. It's like the funniest thing to me.
My kids laugh for that whole scene and when they're chasing him through the field and he's peeking around rocks and stuff.
It's
and
like the best part of the movie.
And his eyebrows are the first thing you notice every time he brings his head up. I mean, it's horrible.
I love when they're hitting him with bricks,
though. Don't throw your bricks till you see the hairs of his eyebrows. The movie kind of follows the classic setup of like a young couple and whatever villainous monster is trying to come between them. And I thought later we're going to talk about The Lost Boys and the sort of acknowledging of like the... That trope is pretty old fashioned. Like we see that in everything from Dracula, Frankenstein, even The Mummy, of like this young idealistic couple whose lives are threatened, their well being is threatened.
Very popular in the early like 20s and 30s.
Yeah,
this
I think it's very like very American, very Christian, very like, you know, get out there, start your family, and there's gonna, you know, be some evil in the
except
way.
For in this case, like in the American ones, they're usually it's like this vibrant, bright girl, woman is the wife or whatever, and she's blonde or she's just bright and she's innocent and beautiful. And this one looks like a Bronte sister. She's like a Debbie Downer.
Yeah, she really
she's
kind
like
of is.
Clinically depressed, and it's pretty wild to watch it, but I think that's like the German take on the whole thing.
She pets her flowers.
Yeah, she does.
She pets the flowers. The kids can't get past that.
She's like really into it, and then she's playing with the cat. And even in my notes, I wrote, let me flip to my notes here. Paper rustling. Rustle, rustle, rustle. At an hour and 5 minutes in, I thought, whatever happened to that cat?
Yeah.
You never see the cat again. I assume she ate it.
Could have been a neighborhood cat. Or Orlok.
Orlok, maybe. We don't know if he eats animals.
I don't think he's above it. So being a silent film, especially this early, the acting is so hyperbolic and like overly animated. It kind of, I figured it kind of falls somewhere between like stage acting and posing for photographs. I think the movie works best in like in clips, in moments where like you're not overanalyzing acting, but you're kind of acknowledging the like set design and the dramatic lighting and the German expressionism just oozing through and through.
Yeah, shadows and angles like crazy.
Yeah. And so it when the actors start going, it's funny, especially in the first couple minutes, like they are it's almost as if they're on like Molly. Like they're so animated.
They're
and excited.
So
it's
into
like they're on
every single thing that they is
and
in
he,
front
like,
of them.
You know, he's all over her. He's hugging, and it's like you know, you could imagine. Yeah, this is.
And he laughs from all the time. Everything is really, really funny to him. And if I was her, who's like clearly suffering from clinical depression, I would just be so angry with him all the time, laughing. Like, nothing is funny. Like, you dropped that item. That's not hilarious. But it is to him for some reason.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I don't know. That would be interesting to sort of question, like, the mental health of all these people before the story.
Right, because he gives her the flowers at the beginning. He gives her a bunch of flowers. And she's, like, so bummed out. And she asks him, why did you kill these flowers? That's not an appropriate response, right. You know?
You mean your... thank you.
My note for that was, because the whole time, and I told you while I was watching it, I was like, I can imagine different dialogue that's way awesome to go with this. And mine was, at that moment, he would say, shut your ungrateful mouth. And then, shh.
We mentioned that they were sued by the Bram Stoker estate, and I think it's pretty famous that this story was going to go into production as a version of Dracula that they, you know, were later forced to sort of edit back. But the differences, I think, are kind of fascinating. That Count Orlok is so much more monstrous than, like, Bela Lugosi ever was.
Well, because Bela's a handsome fella. No, he's great. And something Mom pointed out that I never even noticed is that he never blinks the whole time.
Shrek, really?
What I was thinking when I was
watching it, I think they said that one time in the entire movie do you catch him blinking, because he made it a point not to blink because he felt that an undead wouldn't have moisture in his eyes. He doesn't need to blink.
That's true. That's actually, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shrek was a really awesome guy, and he was known for playing these kind of weirdo roles. And what I kind of like to think of him as, he wasn't hugely popular. He was actually an understudy even after this film came out for several plays in Germany. But he would play these weird, off-putting kind of roles, and it kind of reminded me of Johnny Depp in the early days of Johnny Depp, when he would only play weird, strange, grotesque kind of people. And so I kind of was like, oh, I kind of like this guy. He's an imposing figure at 6'3". He was huge. And when there's a scene where he comes in through one of the arched doorways, and I thought, this set is very small. Because I always assumed he was a little guy because he's so tightly pulled in.
Yeah, yeah.
And very similar to Elsa Lancaster, of using movement, which is incredibly German expressionist movement, to change what you're viewing, what the eye sees. And I always thought he was a little guy until I found out he was 6'3". I thought, holy shit, you know?
That is surprising.
Yeah, I thought he was really short, too. And he's so skinny that he just looks like almost like a spider moving.
Right. It kind of reminds me of the character actor with Marfan's, who's very popular, and he did the record
films. Oh, the Spanish actor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I thought, too, okay, this one woman clearly has clinical depression. Hutter thinks everything is hilarious, so maybe there's something wrong with him there. And Orlok just has Marfan's. And Hutter's, like, really not nice to him. Just by looking at him, it scares him. And I'm like, this man has, like, a disability.
You're staying with him for the evening, but you're still treating him like a monster.
Yeah.
Yeah, before there's reason to.
Yeah. He doesn't know that Orlok's going to, like, try and eat him.
Yeah. That Orlok is, you know, decidedly monstrous kind of simplifies this story. Dracula, especially in the film adaptations, there's, you know, there's a tragic romance at play when he sees, you know, he sees the image of, I guess in Dracula, it's Lucy. Wait, is it Lucy? No, it's Mina.
It's Mina.
In Dracula, you have some amount of empathy for Bela Lugosi. Like, it, for him, it's love at first sight. And when he shows up, you know, he's a very, very cordial, you know, stately man.
He hates mirrors. Breaks some things in the house. But he's very friendly and suave and cool.
Yeah, but here, Orlok sees the image and he comments on, like, her neck, right?
Yeah, he says she has a great neck.
Yeah, so his intentions are, like, very quickly monstrous. And there's no, so you don't get the same turn of empathy and the sort of, you know, tragedy of a monster that you do in the Dracula story. But I guess, I don't know, it speaks to this movie sort of being like a streamlined point. Like, it's a horror movie. It was aiming to be a horror movie.
Yeah.
The special effects in the movie are seemingly also consistent with, like, the German expressionist aesthetic, in that they're otherworldly. They're not, I'm sure for the time it was kind of like the cutting edge, like, turn off the camera, get out of the frame, and now they've blinked, vanished away. I guess at the time that audiences hadn't seen this, it did come off like witchcraft. It's like magic, poof, they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
And it holds a certain amount of wow factor. But it's funny the way that, like, special effects are one of the most telling things to how well a movie ages. Like, we watch those now, and it seems kind of childish. It seems,
when he starts driving the carriage really, really fast, it's hilarious.
Yeah.
And again, it's one of those where I would put Yakety Sax with it, and this shit would be so funny. Yeah. Then I would be like Hutter, and I'd be laughing and thinking this was hilarious.
And my kids did. They laughed through that scene. They're like, how does it not fall over? It looks like it's just going to fall over. And they think it's a toy. I mean, it
does look like a model, yeah.
Yeah, so they just think that's the most ridiculous scene of all. And
I think there's a great effect, though, where they're using double exposure, and he's sitting on the coffin in the ship. Right. And he's transparent, and that was awesome, actually. Still to the when the sailor first sees him like that, it's a pretty great effect.
Even his coming from the coffin is, I mean, it's pretty cool effect.
It holds up. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
and you know, that was shot backwards. He was standing up, they lay him down in the coffin, and then they played it the other way so that it looks like he...
Probably would be heavy. Yeah, to pull him up would probably be hard.
Well, knowing how big he was, I didn't know he was that big. And so, yes, it makes more sense that that would be the easier way to do it, but it was shot the other direction and then just played it so that it looks like he just pops up out of the coffin.
Hooray! Mm.
So, and I even found this little thing online the kids could make. I would print it out of cardstock, and they would make their own Count Orlok that pops out of the coffin out of paper. So,
because every high school kid that's cool needs one of those.
I would have kids come from other classes and go, "Do you have any more of those vampires in the coffin? I want to make one."
So, speaking then of your kids, what would you have them specifically be watching out for?
You know, I start out with all kinds of movies, so there's certain things that we look for in every movie, like establishing shot, because you, and especially nowadays, they give you so much information at the beginning, you pretty much can tell the entire movie before it's even gotten into it, where the older ones don't give you as much of that, but we look for establishing shot. So what are we in for? We listen to what the music tells us about time, place, era, that, you know, where are we at? Why are we, you know... What's going on? What kind of people are we dealing with? Like nowadays, you know, classical music is used, well, in horror a lot, but it's not, classical music isn't used in an action film.
Right.
You're going to use rap, you're going to use music that the average person can relate to. So
pop music.
And so we look for that. We look for special effects and how they change and do they hold up?
Mm-hmm.
And can we figure out how it was done, especially since they're art students? It's stuff that's good for them to look for. With horror, we also look at makeup and costuming because, again, these are art-related fields. How could we make that happen? And, of course, with Max Schreck, they didn't have to do a lot of makeup. He had prosthetic ears and fangs and then his fingers. Hands.
I was going to say.
What are those bugles? He just has some bugles and like powdered sugar on his hands.
Orlok, did you eat your pinky again? We need more bugles on set. Craft services on the line. You mentioned having your students look out for music cues and things of that sort. I'm curious, did you talk about like the idea that this would originally have been, the movie would have been played on the screen, but there would have been an
orchestra
accompanying it?
Yeah. Well, and I actually one year was lucky enough that a small town nearby had just renovated an Art Deco theater. And so they decided to show for Halloween Phantom of the Opera with a quartet.
Okay. The original silent film.
Yes, the original silent film. And they had a quartet down there and accompanied the whole thing. And I was able to take a group of kids to go see it. It was also a wine and cheese thing. The kids didn't get to do that part of it. But...
It's a great experience to see it in the
and to hear the music live like that, and to realize this is how people back then experienced the movie,
right?
And yeah, we do spend a lot of time on the musical cues that, in some cases, I feel is almost insulting because they tell you how to feel. The music gives you that cue. In what I just refer to as hack-em-ups, but like your Saw movies, that kind of thing, where you're just learning different ways to maim and kill people and that. The music gives it away before it ever happens. It tells me when to be scared. I prefer to jump out of my chair because I didn't know it was coming.
Right, right.
Kind of a thing. And so we talk about that is the music tells us stuff. And even in Lost Boys, it's going to tell us stuff. It's some of it's bizarre, but it's going to tell us stuff. And so, they found that kind of interesting because they'd never thought about the fact that they get tensed up because the music told them to.
Now, this one's a great score. It's a score by Hans Erdmann. And the problem is that a lot of it got lost. So I was watching the Kino reproduction, and I don't know who filled in the blanks because they only had some of the original manuscript to go off of. But if you listen to it, It's like an opera. It's scored like an opera. People have themes, and then there's a few diegetic moments where that's the word, right? Diegetic.
Yeah. Yeah. In scene. Yeah.
Yeah. Where there's the drum roll. And I think like how amazing it would have been to sit in that theater, be hearing this beautiful score that's really telling you what's going on. It's a 20th century style score, kind of Wagnerian style. Theory, music theory being used. And then all of a sudden you have this drum roll in the scene. How, like, you're in the show now. I bet it was so exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. It helps pull the audience in. And that's mm-hmm. what I told him. That's what I love about film. It's all the arts put together.
Mm-hmm.
You can't experience just the music. You see the visual, you see the acting, you see the story unfold.
Right.
And so it puts it all together and it's just overwhelming because the only sense really not hit upon most of the time is your sense of smell or taste, kind of a thing.
Right, right.
So.
No, I mean, this is a great film. Clearly, I love that 31 Dracula, like nobody's mm-hmm. business. And to me, that is just living and breathing art. Because I think every single, except for tasting and smelling, but, you know, what are you going to do? That is all-encompassing. This one is a little less beautiful of a film than the Dracula.
Yeah, I guess it's tough. Just even the like tweaked and improved upon versions, I'm sure the Kino version was polished up, even still, like there's no getting around this film, the literal film being, mm-hmm. you know, almost 100 years old now. So yeah, it's got the scratches. It looks of the time. Yeah. I was thinking about the audio component and that this existed before talkies. Yeah, I'd sort of said it before, but the idea that once they introduced sound to the movies, it seemed like there were now so many more things to deal with that, like, now you're dealing with a lot more subtleties in terms of acting and, you know,
right.
dialogue and even just, like, recording all these things and mm-hmm. then having music scored. And it seemed like over the next probably 20 years, the visuals kind of fell off a
yeah.
little bit. Especially, say, like the Universal Monster movie specifically, sort of winding down to Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Mm-hmm.
Like, these are movies where, you know, there's less than brilliant cinematography to them.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this isn't the most beautiful film. Neither is Hexen, which comes out also in 1922 at this
yeah,
time.
Yeah.
But you get the story. You get kind of a well, even though it's acted very what do
harshly,
I want to say?
Harshly.
It's
yeah. very over the top. And very.
But you still kind of get a backstory of all these people, which is surprising, you know, that you can read into it and you don't just take everything at face value.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you also have to keep in mind what was happening in the world at that time, what people had just gotten through. And they mm-hmm. needed monsters that you could actually fight.
Right.
Because there were so many monsters that they couldn't control.
Right. 1922 yeah. Germany was...
Yeah.
Actually, and as far as decadence goes, like really hitting its stride of being very decadent in Berlin and very hedonistic kind of place. So
right.
it's kind of neat to see him covet this guy's wife and the way he sees her picture and like rubs it all over. He's like so excited by
yeah.
it. And she like reads this book in a very sexy, sneaky way later on. And so I you get that this is something in Germany at this point in time that's for 1922 is like out there kind of behavior wise.
That's really interesting to think the cultural crossover from the time it was made in 22 in decadent Germany to hitting the United States in the midst of the Great Depression
mm-hmm.
is that's a trip to think that it really this movie spanned the high low.
Mm-hmm.
That's yeah, I'd never really considered that.
It's probably a great escape though. Think about like it's 1929 America, and it fucking sucks. Like, how exciting to be scared and have something that's not realistic
yeah.
and that's such a great escape, you yeah. know, from the whole thing.
But something you can fight. Something
yeah.
you can actually...
You can win. Good people win at yeah. the end.
And it is cathartic at the end. We do have a clear ending, which a lot of movies anymore don't have. And so there was resolution. Where these people in their real lives have no resolution.
Right.
It sucks. It's going to keep sucking for a while. They don't know when it's going to quit sucking, but I can kill a vampire. So, you know, I can have
yeah.
have something in there that I feel good about.
Yeah. We talked about it on our Universal episodes, which your husband, Mark, was on.
Yeah.
But yeah, that idea that the economy is this intangible and these people mm-hmm. were just suffering, I mean, just because... But here, monster movies present like a singular villain that you can focus on. And, you know, these movies do us the kindness of thwarting evil by the end of it. And we get to, you know, by the time the credits roll, we feel like, you know, demons have been exorcised.
Right. They outsmart them and they win. They're the big winner.
There's that old expression that in good times, people want entertainment. In bad times, people need entertainment. Mm-hmm.
Just before we move on, I took like crazy notes on this because I enjoyed it so much this time watching it. Oh. I like to name some of the scenes as if they should have these titles that I thought were way more awesome. When Nosferatu or Orlok gets on the boat and goes really fast down the water, I call that Nosferatu goes white water rafting. And I really like that scene. Your girlfriend, Rachel, had a statement that then once I watched it every single time, I can't get it out of my head.
Last year, we went to the Lowe's Landmark Cinema in Jersey City. It's this gorgeous theater. It's been around for 80 years, like one of these 50-foot screens, and they had an organist playing, you know, I don't know if it was the very original score, but playing it throughout. And I mean, it was a blast just seeing these images, you know, bigger than gods. And that said, there are moments that just the nature of the old-fashioned hand-cranked cameras, when played at natural speed, there's a fast jitteriness to them. So everything seems almost cartoon-like at times. And so when he has arrived at his new home and he is moving in his coffins, they're under his arm, but he's still, he's so sprightly.
And they're making him go so fast. Yeah.
Yeah. He's jostling forward. And at the time, Rachel kind of leans into me and goes, moving day, moving day.
And so then every time, cause he does it again later, he does the exact same scene, like where he's walking around with his coffins. And I was like, I called the first time I go, oh, that's moving day. That's the scene. As soon as I saw it the second time, I called it moving day part two. So I knew where I was in my notes here.
Well, and the kids love it when the coffins move themselves. When they start stacking
themselves
up.
Yes, when he puts the lid on himself, that's the best scene ever. That's moving day part two.
Okay.
I was just thinking, recently the girls in the back row did Phantasm, and it's difficult to say whether or not it was a little bit of an homage. I can't see how it wasn't, but when the tall man is moving the coffin from the car, I can't remember if he's putting the coffin into the back of the hearse, but he just like one arms it. And it's a great shot because, you know, it's a little kid watching this and he's like, holy hell.
This is the strongest man alive.
Yeah. It's good and creepy. Yeah. Let's bring it up to almost modern. The Lost Boys from 1986, right?
Yeah, 1987.
Okay.
This one is directed by Joel Schumacher, who I think I talked about. I've been talking about St. Elmo's Fire so much lately.
Yep.
But Joel Schumacher also did St. Elmo's Fire in 1985. But here in 1987, he did The Lost Boys. This was written by Janice Fisher and James Jeremias, who would go on to never really write anything again.
Yeah, it's a weird blank space on IMDb for those two. But it turns out the third writer had a bigger part and a bigger career, frankly. Was it James Bohm?
Jeffrey Bohm.
Yeah.
And his IMDb credits go a lot deeper.
And I kind of think he might have come on when Joel Schumacher did, because Joel Schumacher wasn't always attached to this picture.
Yeah, I guess in the very first drafts, oddly enough, the drafts that excited the studio, this was a story akin to, like, Goonies, like, Little Rascals as vampires.
Yeah.
It's hilarious to think that it went from that to what we've come to know as the Lost Boys.
Right.
But the original allusion is like Peter Pan's crew, the Lost Boys.
Right, right.
But this is not that.
No, this is far from that. But what Joel Schumacher does is make it totally late 80s, totally sexy, totally cool, and it's MTV. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Totally.
It's funny, MTV even gets the shout out.
What's wrong with this picture? There's no TV. Have you seen a TV? I haven't seen a TV, Mike.
You know what it means when there's no TV? No MTV.
Sammy, we're flat broke.
This This is starring Kiefer Sutherland as David, Jason Patrick. What? I totally forgot about him. He's doing a sad Rob Lowe impression. He's Michael. My favorite person. The dog's favorite, too. My favorite actor, Corey Haim, who I just loved and I was going to marry until he died a few years ago. And Diane Wiest is in it, yeah. Who's like the real deal. She's actually like a real actor.
She's fantastic.
She's on like Broadway and everything, you guys. And I mean, there's other people too, but then rounding out the most important people, I would say, is Corey Feldman as Edgar Frog.
This is the famous point where the Coreys met.
Yes.
Yeah. So the story starts out, and I mentioned it because I wanted to come back to it, but the original classic setup of like a young couple being torn apart by monsters. This story starts out so much more modern. We're mm-hmm. like, this is a broken family seeking refuge.
Yeah.
And so we've got, you know, single mom with her two boys and a dog.
Yeah.
Going to live with her dad to sort of put their lives back together.
What's interesting even, because, and we were talking about as we were watching it last night, there's so much you can infer from Diane Wiest and what she's doing. Wiest?
Yeah, I always said Wiest, but okay. Wiest, I'm not sure which it is.
If I was speaking German, it would be Wiest. There's so much you can infer from her because she's leaving with the kids and you find out she's just recently divorced. The kids never mention the dad. She seems kind of like a doormat. She wanted to get out of there quick, easy, painless as possible. I mean, there's a lot of backstory going on
here.
Yeah,
they don't dwell on it, but it seems like it was ugly enough that they wanted to cut ties.
Yeah.
This is like some witness protection program for you.
Yeah, and I think that's like kind of brilliant that you can infer all this stuff in...
opening. Yeah,
exactly. In the first 3 minutes, you can tell a lot about this family.
But that's also her acting. You have to give her credit for that because she conveys all of that. And with just that simple line to her dad of...
Lucy, you're the only woman I ever knew didn't improve her situation by getting divorced.
Yeah, I know. But a big legal battle wasn't going to improve anybody's situation. You know, Dad, we've all been through enough. You know, anyway, I was raised better than that.
Hey, ouch, my hair.
You do get that feeling that she feels blessed or lucky just to have gotten out of it.
Right.
And mm-hmm. gotten the kids and the dog and a carload of shit. And that's it. That's what she's got.
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess we've exchanged Santa Cruz, California for Santa Clara, California.
Santa Carla.
Carla. Yeah.
Because why not mix that L up?
Because it'll fool everyone.
Exactly.
It's like Tarzana.
So they kind of talk. I guess they never really address it specifically. We see it on the back of the billboard welcoming the driver into the town. But the idea is that this is the murder capital of the United States.
Yeah.
And I think it harkens back to Santa Cruz got a lot of heat back in the 80s for being like quote unquote murder city.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to do with a couple localized killers. But of course, like reporters get to it, sensationalize
of course,
it. But
of course.
this was never the like highest crime rate city in the United States.
Right, right.
It's funny, the 1986, it was filmed in 86, the people who were meant to be the weirdos and it's
are
funny.
Cool, right? That was my first note. I said, these people are fucking cool and this seems like an awesome place to go to.
Considering how like the like modern retro look, a lot of these people look like they were just like yoinked out of Williamsburg. They're just like, get in the van, we're taking you, you're an extra now.
This is how I imagine Austin to be, because I imagine Austin, Texas is like one of the coolest places ever. I've never been there, but it seems like really cool. And I imagine like it's like that opening homage with Echo and the Bunnymen there.
Yeah. It's the cover of The Doors, People Are Strange?
People Are Strange, yes. Right.
Which is, you know, we talk about Mickey Mousing, which is a term that, of course, Disney, but sure. That's what they do for music. It's Mickey Mousing because cartoons used to do
it's
that.
Telling
to tell
you everything you need to
everything
think.
You need to know. And some movies are more about that than ever. And Stephen King, even when he writes, he'll write lyrics of a song or he'll start a chapter with the lyrics of
a
song. Mm. He's Mickey Mousing for you, even though it's in print.
Right, right.
And People Are Strange is just perfect. You know,
just great alluding to Jim Morrison. And
right.
Later you have the big Jim Morrison poster because Lost Boys.
Yeah, he was lost. I mean, he was lost to a generation. And by dying young, he never ages, never gets old. You know, and that's another thing we discuss is taglines and how important a tagline is for selling a movie. And
This tagline was awesome. Kind of long, but totally awesome.
Oh, I don't remember this one.
Oh, it's the tagline was sleep all day, party all night, never grow old, never die. It's fun to be a vampire. Being wild is in their blood.
Ooh, yeah.
Who doesn't want to be a vampire?
Yeah. No kidding. And I think a lot of those words come out of Kiefer Sutherland's mouth.
Yeah, probably. He's so to, like, cool in
he's
this.
He's trying to sell
it to sell Michael.
Sell it to him. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now you know what we are. Now you know what you are. You'll never grow old, Michael. And you'll never die. But you must feed.
What I like about it, though, is that they're cool and they're sexy and they're having fun and they love this life. They are monsters. It's not like they're going out and sparkling, and it's not like they're even like Louis or Lestat being so tormented and all this shit. They're monsters through and through.
Yeah. They play both parts really well.
Well, and Schumacher did a good job, again, with it being the teenagers in that, because you're, like you guys said, the people of Santa Carla are what we would consider cool. But at the time, older people were scared shitless of all, you know, of the punk look and the spiked hair and all.
I suppose that's true.
They thought of them as monsters. And who were the coolest kids in this entire movie? The vampires were.
Right, yeah. Right.
They were the cool kids that Michael wanted to be part of. He wanted to be part of the Scooby gang.
Definitely. Not to be overlooked, though, is Corey Haim's wardrobe in this. He's dressed so cool. All of his clothes are big sized, apparently.
Yeah,
I don't...
it looks like he's in a Talking Heads video.
Yeah, I kind of like wonder if like they didn't have him in mind at first, and they were like, you just put this other kid's clothes on, please. These were meant for someone who was 6 foot tall, but you put these on, little kid. But he's very cool for like a teenage kid. Very cool looking.
Yeah. So the movie, one of the earliest kills, it's what the, and they do it twice, the death from above.
Yeah, of course,
POV,
why not?
Camera kills. And so this wasn't long after Evil Dead, so the idea of giving, you know, this ups the ante from like slashers or, you know, Black Christmas or the original Halloween. RPOV is swooping in, you know, to murder.
Yeah.
And that said, like, we don't see it, so it kind of works in some of the best ways of horror, like the deaths happening off camera.
Mm-hmm.
So you might get you know, a scream here or there, but for the most part you were just imagining this person being like pulled into the air and torn apart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really love those. I thought they were really creative, and you hadn't seen something like that before.
No, I mean, it's coming in fast. There's a scene in particular you were telling me about last night, the backwards spider.
Oh, yeah, they shot it, they filmed it backwards. And okay. So they filmed going into the cave. But so then when the vampires leave the cave to go and wreak havoc in that, they just play it backwards. And it gives you this unsettling feeling. And even the waves, if you really start looking, you realize the water is even wrong.
Coming in,
yeah, and so you're getting that. And that's one of the things we talk about, the psychology of how things are filmed. We're used to reading left to right.
Mm.
And so usually if you watch especially older films, good people enter from the left and move to the right, and evil people come from stage right and come in because they're going against what is considered the norm. And so anytime we can take us out of our comfort zone of expecting movement to go left to right, if we reverse it, then we're discombobulated in our little brains, and it helps put that unease out there.
I had never considered that.
I never even thought about it.
I feel like in a month I'm going to give you a call and say, you ruined horror movies for me.
And my job is done. So I actually had a kid when Twitter was new tweet because of my hatred of Barbara and how I ruined Night of the Living Dead for them. But yeah, so I mean,
Twitter, where kids go to complain about teachers ruining horror films.
Yeah, kind of a thing, but... but yeah, so I mean, the whole way they shot that is just to give you that unease. And like I said, you've got society going, oh, those punk kids, those no good kids, they need to get off my lawn. Yeah. They're tearing everything up. Well, these kids are killing.
Yeah.
And what I loved about it is at the beginning, it's all implied. We don't see how they get killed. It's not until later, and mostly against the vampires themselves, that we actually see the violence on screen.
You don't really see the humans ever violence on the humans.
The one beach scene.
The beach.
That's when we see like just how monstrous the Lost Boys are. And then when the Lost Boys start. The
finale.
Yeah.
And we had to in the beach scene because that one guy had already been killed once and then shows up in that beach scene and gets killed a second time. They want to make sure he's dead this time. So.
I think, you know, you can't talk about this movie without mentioning the soundtrack, though. Because this.
Awesome.
Darren comes into work today and he said, I loved it so much again last night. I watched it twice.
Yeah.
Because it's so cool and the music's so great.
I finished it and I was like, I am so jet. Like, I've got the energy. Let's watch this again. And I rolled back. And
it's a soundtrack. Like, my husband Jackson, he listens to it all the time, the soundtrack. Just the soundtrack, because it's a hot fire soundtrack. I'm not going to lie. And it's for free on YouTube right now.
I was going to say, my students went and downloaded the soundtrack after watching that movie.
We were watching it last night, and Jackson was singing every single word to all the songs. But we can't, you know, even talk about the music, though, without mentioning the sexy sax man.
He's infamous.
Yes.
You know what? My memory, you know, we taped it off of cable back in probably the late 80s, early 90s. So this is one of those movies that I've seen a ton.
Right, right.
However, my memory of the sexy sax guy was just like waiting for the sax solo. Otherwise, he was just gyrating. But he's also the lead singer.
He's also the singer. I mean, yeah. This man, he is not only a singer and saxophone player, but a hell of a dancer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And mention built that dancing.
Like Glenn Danzig, like one of the Misfits. Like,
yeah. And he's so oily and shiny.
Oh, yeah.
And like he's gross, but at the same time, like you're also kind of turned on by him.
This was peak late 80s sexy. Yeah.
There's like so much to think, and I was very confused, and I wonder if I could imagine myself as a kid, like, did I think this was sexy as a kid? I don't know. I remember thinking David Bowie in Labyrinth was sexy, but I don't know. Now as an adult, I'm like, I have so many mixed feelings about the sexy sax man.
My students thought he was an idiot. they thought he was just ridiculous, and they didn't understand why that was sexy, my students now.
He's like a cooler Glenn Danzig. The makeup on this is really awesome, and yeah, they're cool and sexy Lost Boys, but when they vamp out, they vamp out and they're gruesome, horrific monsters.
Yeah.
The makeup was done by Greg Canham and his team, which he'd been working for quite a while. But he did Thinner. He was responsible for Thinner, for Stuff in the Mask, and even part of Dream Warriors. He worked on the crew for Dream Warriors, too. So for some of those. So he had his team working and created some really nice,
very amazing work.
It's a unique vampire look, and it took me one or two glances, and I might have rewound back, but typically, I think vampire teeth are like the bicuspid or the canine.
We were talking about this last night.
And he chose not to use the canines, but used whatever the...
What are these?
The one right next to your...
I don't know
what
they're
called. They are the maxillary central incisors.
All right.
So it's next to your two front teeth.
Yeah.
Those are their vampire teeth. And it lends it such a distinct look from every other vampire movie you've ever seen.
I kind of like it because it's similar in some ways to... It's like the middle man between Nosferatu, it's his front teeth.
Mm.
Or Locke's front teeth and Nosferatu. And then these guys are like one out. And then your normal vampire nowadays would be...
It's the canines. Yeah, that exactly. Are brought out.
Yeah. It's funny. The like tradition of the two puncture wounds of a vampire bite... I mean, if anybody's nerding out about the dentistry, like, that's not what a vampire bite would look like. You would get the full chompers before you even arrive at the canines.
Right.
However, these, like, protrude beyond the two front teeth, so that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, it works. It really works with that. And well, that's another thing that we discuss is all the rules that change in the vampire movies from Nosferatu to even more modern. We go beyond, you know, the Lost Boys. We just don't have time for the more modern tale.
Mm-hmm.
But how the rules change so that it meets the needs of the filmmaker.
And what do your students kind of think about that? About dissecting the mythology of the vampire? I mean, mostly I would say people are English, Irish in your neck of the woods. Not Eastern European. So you're not getting grandma telling you these crazy stories.
No, we do... You forget the Westville area has a lot of Western European. But for the area that I teach in, it's going to be mostly your...
American
lore and that. So no, although there's a lot of superstitious families in the community, and, you know, the kids will talk ghosts are big. I mean, they all can tell you stories of seeing grandpa's house has a ghost or some, you know, stuff like that.
Really?
Oh, it's unbelievable that, they have a tale of, that somebody was in the house and, but then they checked and no one was there. And grandma said that there's been a ghost living there since God knows when. And
they take it at face value. It's the truth. The
gospel truth. Mm-hmm. And they believe that these spirits are there, and it's just cool in that. But with, because we talked about that with vampires. I said, when I grew up, I believed that they were real. I mean, I was scared to death of vampires. I ran home every day to watch Dark Shadows just so I could get my dose of scare. But I relied on those rules. The rules had to be there because those were things I could use to protect myself. But if you keep changing the rules...
I don't know. Can I throw a bunch of coins on the ground? Are you going to count them? Or are you just going to come get me?
Yeah, exactly. If I cover my neck, am I safe or are they going to bite my ankle?
Right. Can I do the cross with anything? Do crosses work at all?
Exactly.
What if I'm Jewish? What do I do with this kind of stuff? And so I said, there's no consistency with those rules. And that was one of the things when I introduced zombie movies was I said, I'm an old-fashioned girl. I like my zombies old-fashioned. I want them slow and stupid like freshmen. That's what I go for. That's what I want. And so like 28 days later, whatever, 28 days, either one.
How are you my mom? 28 days later.
Later, 28
days is a Sandra Bullock rehab movie.
How are you my mother?
Well, because I was trying to think, what was the next one?
After 28 weeks later.
Weeks. Yeah. Okay, because we're going to go days, weeks, months, years, whatever. But with that one, when I watched it, I hated it because they're fast.
Mm.
And I'm
because you can't outrun them.
I can't outrun them. And I told the kids, I go, but I know a secret. I don't have to be the fastest person. I just have to be faster than one other person.
Exactly.
And I will trip you.
You and Tony are on a team together.
I was going to say, now I know where you get it. Yeah.
I'm not the pusher.
Oh, she's
going to
leave me behind. I am dead. She will sacrifice me in a heartbeat.
My skill is that I can fit into really tiny spaces and I can sit still and quiet for a really long time.
She can. That's true. It's true. I'm dead.
Before you mentioned I guess it's more about the choreography than the editing, but the idea of good characters coming from left to right, bad coming from right to left. And it brought to mind the editing. And this movie makes the most of the editing to the extent where they actually get by a lot of special effects. And the movie wasn't that big a budget. It was shot surprisingly fast. If I'm going to take the internet's word for it, it was shot in 3 weeks.
That's amazing. For a film so slick and so seamless. Yeah.
But they do get by with moments like, the sort of cutaway, cut back, the person, star is through the window.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
She's one of them. And don't tell me it doesn't make her a bad person, Mike.
Sound effects and clever editing lend to it's funny, but the almost the otherworldliness of Nosferatu that is just kind of par for the course in terms of the aesthetic, this gets by. There's a lot of, smoky montages.
Yeah,
in this
of course.
There,
synth drums,
there's
of course.
A little bit of silliness when Michael is sort of falling through the mist backwards, but he's clearly standing.
We were laughing about that. Yeah, he's just like leaning back really far.
He's doing the Matrix fall backwards as slow as he can.
Like a smoke machine and just yell.
We were waiting for him to go, look, I'm falling.
Trust me.
Yeah, so it's funny that that scene consisted of a smoke machine and some slow motion acting.
Yeah.
But it works. It gets you from one scene to the next.
Yeah, yeah.
And you don't second guess. It's just kind of par for the course. And they use light a lot. The sort of strobe effects and the sort of wagging through, these smoky atmospheres. The sound goes a long way when they seemingly ride their motorcycles to, the outside of Michael's house. And they're just... You assume they're like doing donuts outside of his house.
Right.
And the house is in a complete tizzy. Everything's shaking.
Yeah, yeah.
And, what that scene consists of is just a lot of noise and some flashing of lights, but it's scary.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Wind machine is the wind machine is everyone's friend in this film. There's so much wind machine to direct which way things are happening.
And I imagine these techie guys on the other side of the walls where Michael and Sam are there, and they're just shaking the shit out of the side of that building, you know. But you can't see them, but we're supposed to be so scared because it's the motorcycles and that. But it's very low tech, if you will. But
it's like two guys shaking the walls.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. In terms of the characters sort of occasionally popping out of nowhere, it occurred to me that it felt very natural. When I was watching it, I was thinking it displays on screen essentially how it would come off to a person witnessing it. The idea that like the vampires are moving too fast for you to see anyway.
Right.
So there's no special effect that would really do it justice. It's just boom, they're there.
Yeah, we didn't have to have any sped up film, any moving day scenes, none of that. Moving day. No, I thought this is one of those films, I think it looks so good because it's vague on purpose in those parts, in parts where it could look, especially in 1987, very hokey. They really did a great job with just omitting that. Like, right. Oh, this is going to look like shit. Let's just not do it. Okay, great. Move on.
Yeah, we're not going to apologize. This is what we have to work with, and we're going to give it our best shot.
Right. If Kiefer Sutherland didn't have that mullet, I think this would be a pretty timeless kind of film. I mean, the soundtrack clearly dates it, but it's a very relevant film to today same speed as movies today.
It's well written, and the characters, like, there isn't a bad actor amongst them.
Right, right.
Even, I mean, Corey Feldman's character is there a lot for sort of comic relief, but you get that this is, you know, a 16-year-old kid trying his damnedest to act hard.
Right.
And every once in a while, you get the sort of great sort of scare where, you know, he's shaken, and like for him, who's an actor playing a part of a guy playing a part,
right?
And every once in a while you get, you know, that character has this shit scared out of him, and he breaks, and you know, and they're allowed to be scared kids, and it's those moments that lend to why this doesn't come off as false.
Right. And what you have with the sad kind of story with the Frog Brothers, because their parents, you assume, are the parents who own the store, and they're passed out hippies.
Well, they're always kind of the John and Yoko looking situation.
Yeah, and they're completely passed out. They don't know what's going on. So these are two kids that just raise themselves.
And are running that store because they're working the comic book slash
video. And fighting
video.
The forces of evil.
Yes.
There's a lot of responsibility on those Frog Brothers.
And it's named Edgar and Alan.
Yes, right? Yeah,
nice. You know, they don't have much going for them. I mean, these poor kids are screwed from the get-go.
I just think there's like so much, and I could have seen where they would have gone with making them smaller kids and maybe playing maybe a little more seriously or maybe a little more blatantly with their backstories if they were smaller kids, but because you had competent actors doing it, you can infer all the shit from just one setup scene.
Yeah, because the description had them as chubby little Boy Scouts.
Aww.
That were going to fight the vampires. Chubby. They couldn't just be Boy Scouts. They had to be chubby little Boy Scouts. But no, and I think they're great because they get all of their skills, all of their knowledge from comic books, which is a kid thing to do.
Right.
Take this.
I don't like horror comics.
You like this one, Mr. Phoenix. It could save your life.
And then when some of that doesn't work, especially in the cave and that.
We knew that.
Yeah, we knew that. Yeah. We have to reevaluate, you know, kind of, where they're like, oh, shit, you know.
Yeah, but they're adaptable.
Yeah, yes. They are.
It's funny, for as much gravitas as they carry themselves with, it is funny to think that, I mean, they treat it like this is like case 17 in our career.
Yes.
We are jaded vets at this point.
But I kind of don't think they've ever killed any.
Of course not. Yeah. No. Yeah. That's one of my favorite elements, that like these guys talk the best game, but when they're shaken, I mean, it lends to the comedy of it.
The Frog Brothers will always remain two of my favorite characters in any of my movies, because you wish you knew them. They're singularly focused.
I think the fun part about the character and the comic value of it is that he doesn't think it's funny, and he's not in on the joke. So it's one of those people that you just kind of have to laugh at, because, you know, they really take themselves very seriously, and they believe every word of what they're saying about themselves or whatever it is they believe in. Whereas, you know, as an outsider, you can kind of look at this guy and be like, oh my God, what's wrong with him?
Kill you, brother. You'll feel better.
He wanted us to be really tough and totally cold, tough. To the point that I thought that's what the characters were. I didn't realize until maybe halfway through the project that it was funny what we were, you know, what we were doing.
We blew it, man. We lost it.
Shut up.
We unraveled in the face of the enemy.
It's not our fault. They pulled the mind scramble on us. They opened their eyes and talked.
I told them they were Marines, commandos. Well, they don't think they're funny. They're going to kill vampires. You better not make fun of the Frog Brothers. I'll have them stake you.
Right.
No, they're dead serious. They are the G.I. Joes of this movie.
Yeah. Their collective, like, our gang moments are some of the funniest.
Mm-hmm.
When they run into the church to collect holy water.
I love that scene.
It's fucking hilarious.
And everyone turns and is looking.
And they don't, they're just like,
the looks that the three guys are giving to the priest and the party that's being baptized and everything are just so funny.
Yeah.
And I wonder, like, did they do it different ways? Maybe what were some of the other ways? Because, you know, what you know about Corey Feldman is that that kid is an actor. He's a man now, but even as a kid, like, he was an actor that really respected the craft, and he would try things different ways, and he would take it with the same seriousness than a Broadway in legit play actor would take it. And so it's kind of great just how I'm sure he made everyone better just being around him, because as a kid, he was really great. And I just wonder if he tried that scene different ways. I would have loved to have seen some of the different
takes. And I'm sure he did, because you know that he worked on several voices before he decided on gravelly.
Of course.
I've got to sound older than I am.
Of course.
But when I'm Edgar Allan, whichever one I am,
right,
then, you know, I've got to be tough. I've got to be scary.
Because you think even about his voice compared to when he's in Stand By Me, it's a different voice.
Oh, sure.
It's a different kid. It's a different, and not because he's older, it's just different.
And Goonies, his voice there. I mean, he really is. I think he's an underappreciated.
He actually was a really great actor.
Yeah. So no, those characters are great in that, and they just make it. But again, when the rules don't, you know, they've got this comic book that tells them this is how you figure stuff out, and it doesn't work, then they're like, oh shit, what do we do now?
What's plan? Right. They even say, what's plan B? We haven't thought of it yet.
Yeah,
we got to work on that.
I have to mention, just because it's one of my favorite lines in the movie, and seeing it again last night made me laugh so hard. I don't know if you noticed, there's a scene where when Max comes over to dinner with Diane Wiest,
mm-hmm.
and the kids, then the Frog Brothers are also invited over, but the mom doesn't know that the Frog Brothers are coming for dinner, and Sam just says, hey, my friends are here also for dinner. And she's like, oh, okay. And Sam, that's Corey Haim, he has this line, and it's so funny, and he says,
well, Mom, you know, if we're in your way, we can go eat some peanut butter
dry
in the kitchen.
No, there's plenty for everybody. Max, this is my son, Sam, and Edgar and Alan Frog.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to me, that's like one of the funniest lines that I've ever heard.
It's because it's so pathetic.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll be pathetic, Mom. We can do this.
I'm just going to go eat some peanut butter.
Out of the jar, just straight out of the jar. Not even a sandwich. Can't even get this kid a sandwich, you know.
Jason Patrick, who is almost stoic in the movie, like he's kind of he's too cool for school. Even when he's, I thought it was funny that speaking to the rules, the idea that half vampires that aren't fully turned upon their first kill, they're just sleepy, they're drowsy. The sunlight makes them tired.
Yeah.
It's almost like a American Horror Story hotel.
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
because you can go out, but I'm a little soggy.
Yeah. So Jason Patrick, I didn't know this, but he's actually a junior. He's the son of Jason Miller, who played Father Karras in The Exorcist.
I did not know that.
Did not know that either.
Patrick is his middle name, it turns out.
Oh, that makes sense.
Like, he's got a lineage to him.
I did not know that.
He needs to learn to shut his mouth, though.
He does
talk. He cannot. No, I mean, he just always has it hanging open. Somebody told him that was sexy or something.
Yeah, Corey Feldman, or Corey Haim is doing that, too, always with the mouth open. I think they have, like, really bad sinus problems.
It might be.
No, I think he's trying to be sexy, because I think throughout this whole movie, he's doing like a Rob Lowe impression.
Yeah, who makes a cameo on a poster.
Yes, of course.
Haim's room.
Yeah, because what does every little boy have but a picture of Rob Lowe in a crop top on his closet door?
Yeah,
that my was students thought that was very strange.
Joel Schumacher applying.
Yeah. Oh, he was. Joel Schumacher was like, I bet Rob Lowe was offered that first. I would bet you anything.
I could see that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so between these two movies, like Nosferatu and The Lost Boys, which would the students like more, probably?
Do you want to guess?
I mean, I would guess they're more relatable to The Lost Boys.
Yes, they love The Lost Boys, and which I was worried because of the it's almost 30 years kind
yeah,
of a
it's
thing,
almost 30
you know?
Years old.
But it was so successful when I first started showing it that I just kept playing it and hoping mm-hmm. that kids would still relate to it. And
when did you start showing it? In the 90s?
Yes, it would have had to have been probably as I kept pushing the boundaries to see what I could get away with in this class of what I could teach, then I added horror in the 90s. So, yeah, it would have been sometime then. And like I said, I've played with several different movies trying to figure out what a good combination is. And mm-hmm. for me, you've got the seriousness of Nosferatu, and this is a little – it's still serious. I mean, mm-hmm. there's vampires killing people left and right, but it's more like a music video. It's very upbeat. It's very fast-paced.
Right.
So it kept the kids' attention. So, yeah, they liked it. They thought it really captured that, like I said, the MTV generation, the whole new music video situation. And
cool. But they, you know, Nosferatu maybe not so much.
No, that was very difficult for them. I have to give them credit. My kids generally would force themselves to get through it.
They wouldn't fall asleep. That would piss
no,
me off.
No, there were a couple that did, and yes, it would piss you off. It does. It does, trust me. I had a couple kids that were just, if it's black and white, I can't watch it. Sure you can. Open wow. your
what
eyes.
What does that even mean?
Wow.
Like, what?
I know. I don't understand that logic, but.
I'd be like, get out.
Yeah.
You have to.
Well, and I actually did one time say, you know, maybe this isn't the class for you. It's sort of like I do a unit on musicals, movie mm-hmm. musicals, and I go, they're going to sing and dance. And I'll still have some asshole kid that'll go, the Jets were dancing down the street. That's just freaking ridiculous. It's a musical. It's what they do.
And you're like, yeah, and they look fucking cool as hell. Yeah, also, let's see you do that. Those people's feet bled every single day for that film.
Oh, I give them the list of how many shoes they went right. through and all of that kind of stuff. But yeah, it's just like, I warned you ahead of time. It's a musical. They're going to sing. They're going to dance. It's what you do in a musical.
Yeah, I remember like being filled with great rage one time when you told me that someone laughed at River Phoenix's character in the Stand By Me one time when he cries. And like the thought of someone laughing during that scene like makes me just see red. Like,
oh, me
as a
too.
Teacher, I don't know how you could sit there and be like, what planet are you on right now?
Well, and see, and I have to wait till I get to the end of the, you know, for my 10-minute, you know, wrap it all up kind of a thing. And then usually I would get on them because that is such a powerful scene. Mm-hmm. And for a boy that age to break down, and it's because his trust was totally annihilated.
Right, right.
You should be able to trust a teacher, and she stole from him. Yeah, maybe he did it first, but she stole. And mm-hmm. it was sort of the, if you can't trust, and his trust in the world was gone. I mean, he's such a good actor and
right.
was such a was, good actor. Yeah. And yeah, for the kids to laugh at that, just it would just tear me apart. It's like mm-hmm. for me in West Side Story when John, you know, baby John puts the shawl on Maria's shoulders at the end when Tony dies, mm-hmm. and my kids are laughing.
Spoiler alert!
Oh, spoiler! Sorry, but that scene tears me up. I sometimes would got a call in the office, and I would leave so I didn't have to watch that scene because I want to cry every time I see that scene.
Yeah, I think that would be hard about showing it in a school setting. Is yeah, not everyone loves it or.
Yeah.
Reveres it as much as you do.
And it does make it tough. And there were times you just want to go up and punch a kid, but I wanted to get a pension. So I refrained.
Were there ever any times that you didn't show a film maybe because they would have pissed you off?
I was about to ask that. Yeah.
Actually, I dropped a couple films because the kids' reactions. I can't think off the top of my head what I dropped, but their reaction, to the film so angered me that they didn't mm-hmm. see what was going on and how good the film was that I pulled a few films from the rotations because of that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, because you can't punch a kid in school.
No, you cannot.
You cannot. It's a,
even
it's
if
a rule.
They have bad taste in movies.
Yeah. You know, just rules. Like vampire killing, there's rules.
Well, you're the man of the house. And I'm not coming in until you invite me.
You're invited.
Did kids ever suggest movies to you that were just stupid?
Oh, all the time. You know, they all want, well, for horror, they, of course, usually all they really want is either a Freddy movie or they want Saw or And I'm not saying that these aren't great movies for what they're doing, but they don't really want to. I wanted to go back to the roots of horror.
Sure, sure.
And so that's why I used Nosferatu. I usually would show a Hitchcock, and I showed Night of the Living Dead. Mm-hmm. And they didn't want Night of the Living Dead. They wanted something more, a more modern.
The Dawn of the Dead remake.
That's excellent, actually. That's excellent film.
But I mean, they would want something a little, you know, they didn't want to see it because it's black and white. Night of the Living Dead, black and white, God forbid. Can't watch that. But usually then once they got into it, they usually would relent and realize that it was a good show. But kids could ruin it
That
for
they
you.
Were watching some older movies, did they ever recognize that, like, oh, this movie that I like was doing that? Did they recognize influences?
They started to, because that's one of the things I would also point out, and the fact that a lot of movies will steal from paintings. See, they'll set up scenes directly out of a painting or out of, out of some specific literature or something.
Yeah. And what is that, Christina's World? Everyone does that in every film in the world.
They do that. Well, and E.T. stole the spark of life from the Sistine Chapel, you know, kind of a thing. But it does, and that did change how they viewed a lot of stuff.
Do kids think of Twilight, those movies, as horror?
No.
Did that come up?
No, Twilight, they looked at that more as a romance. Mm-hmm. You know, I looked at it as just bad literature, but
it's poorly written. It's true. But actually, our friends at Miskatonic Musing, you know, they had Punishment. Right. I told you about it because I laughed maniacally on the phone when I told you I won.
Yes.
they just did their Twilight episode, and they had a guest, Molly Tanzer, who actually pointed out just some interesting things, and every listener should go listen to that episode because it's easy to make fun of Twilight, but I kind of respect a little more after hearing Molly's kind of views on that. So I'm not going to shit on Twilight, Darren.
Okay. I was going to say it's a non sequitur, but there is a segue. Twilight having sparkly vampires. The Lost Boys, the abundant use of blood also factored in glitter.
Yes, it did. We talked about that last night, too.
Yeah.
We don't ride with vampires.
Fine, stay here.
We do now.
Yeah.
So I think it's most visible in the sunlight. So after the Frog Brothers and, you know, the whole team goes down and stab Alex Winter.
Yeah, come on.
I don't remember. Well, I guess, is he Ted? I don't remember if he's Bill or Ted.
I don't know, but that was totally bogus when they stabbed him.
You're a nerd.
I am.
Yeah, so I guess when they hit the sunlight, they, you know, every spot of blood
super
is illuminated
sparkly.
By sparkles. Yeah. I thought that was actually almost like very glam. I mean, very of
it
the
is
era.
Very glamorous, but also, like, you know how glitter is really hard to get out of. You can never get rid of glitter. So now that every other vampire knows that you just killed a vampire, or that you like glitter,
and I didn't allow glitter in the art room. Glitter is the herpes of the art world.
That's a Demetri Martin joke.
I don't. Yes, but it is. It's everywhere. Once you get it, you can't get rid of it. I hate glitter in the art room, so it was never allowed.
I love glitter. Bring on
the
glitter.
I love the way it looks. I just don't want it in the art room.
I'm confused in many ways how you're my mom.
I could tell you the biological reason why I am your mother, but
no one wants to hear that.
No. Definitely not.
Gross out.
So that'll wrap it up for this interview/compare and contrast. Thank you for joining us, Lori.
Yeah, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks. I was a little worried, but I think it's okay.
Yeah, no. And I think if we're going even, Steven, you've got one more appearance to make up before, to sort of match Mark.
Well, he's already working on how you could have him on the show again.
Yeah, he won't shut up about Count Yorga. Oh, my God. That man in Count Yorga. I don't know.
Yeah, he's a little crazy about some stuff.
So that's it for this episode. You can find us on all the social media. We are on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Rants Macabre. Our website is therantsmacabre.com, where we've always got extra content. And I just put up the Summer Camp Horror first part episode from last year.
Yeah.
So it's a video podcast. It's a little bit warts and all, but have a look.
You can see how we do things.
Let us know what you think.
Not well.
Our email is therantsmacabre@gmail.com. And find us on Stitcher or Google Play Music or iTunes and drop us a review. It goes a long way to help out.
You've been listening to The Rance Macabre, a presentation of the Fangoria Podcast Network, produced by Darren Rosario and Thomas DeFeo, and executive produced by Ken Hanley of Fangoria Entertainment. For press opportunities, advertising inquiries, and information about The Rance Macabre, contact Ken at fangoria.com.
This is me, Darren, signing off.
And this is Mindy. Thanks.
Strangers look on. When will they love this loneliness? Temptation heat beats like a drum deep in your veins.